from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I want to start off by saying thank you to House members, Republican and Democrat, who came together today to pass an important component on our strategy for dealing with this terrible terrorist organization known as ISIL. And I want to, in particular, thank Speaker Boehner and Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi for showing us that when it comes to America's national security, America's united. So I very much appreciate all of you in the efforts that you made there. America's now positioned better than we could have ever imagined if we continue to act in the interests of all of us and if every once in a while we're willing to set aside politics and try to get something done. And so hopefully a picnic like this just reminds us of the fact that there are a lot of people all across the country counting on us to be able to work together. That doesn't mean we don't have strong passions and strong arguments, but it also means that every once in a while we've got to set those aside, embrace compromise, and try to get some stuff done. That's what people are looking for, and today, I think, on national security, at least, we showed that we could.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Wednesday, shortly after the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill authorizing the training and arming of fighters in Saudi Arabia to fight in Syria for the alleged purpose of confronting the group known as ISIL, ISIS, and the Islamic State. An unusual coalition in the House voted 273 to 156 in favor of the bill, which was strongly and actively supported by both the Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. But to paraphrase the late comedian Rodney Dangerfield, it wasn't all moonlight and canoes on the floor of the House, as a number of members expressed their deep dissatisfaction with the plan in deep detail. Republican Representative Paul Brown, from Georgia, began by reminding his colleagues that Congress, not the President, has the sole power to make war.
Today, 227 years ago, on September the 17th, our founding fathers signed our nation's most precious document, the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution states, Congress shall have the power to declare war. The President does not have that power, only Congress. Congress gives our President the power to defend our country. However, that authority remains subject to checks and balances, particularly by this body. As such, if the President believes a state of war exists between ourselves and ISIL, the comments made by both Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State indicate that he does, then let him make it constitutional by first coming to Congress and asking for that declaration. Today, the House will vote on the President's request to authorize assistance to train and arm the Syrian rebels. I have long opposed arming the Syrian opposition out of the fear that these weapons will fall into the hands of Islamic radicals, such as ISIL. Rather than supporting relatively unknown opposition groups in Syria to battle these forces, the Islamic State, we must instead turn to our long-standing allies, the Kurds. The Kurds have shown repeatedly that they have the capacity, the tenacity, and the will to stand up to ISIL. The Kurdish Peshmerga, together with the Iraqi security forces, will be able to successfully annihilate the evil forces of ISIL. In conclusion, Madam Chair, if the President wishes to engage this country in military action against ISIL, then I urge him to ask Congress for a declaration of war. Therefore, I ask my colleagues to join me in opposition to this amendment.
Democratic Representative Lloyd Doggett from Texas said that ISIS does not constitute a sufficient threat to the U.S. to justify what he called a full-scale war, and called into question the message being sent by training a so-called democratic opposition in Saudi Arabia. He also said the president should seek a declaration of war.
I respect all of my colleagues on the tough decisions that we're asked to make today. I believe that America must use our military might any time that our families face an imminent threat. Though ISIS, like a number of terrorist groups around the world, would like to kill more Americans, our military has made it clear, our leadership has made it clear that ISIS does not represent such a threat today. It is a regional threat without the capacity to do the harm it would like to do. Rejecting this one amendment does not mean doing nothing about ISIS. The president already has the necessary authority to respond to this savagery when Americans are murdered. Now the president's response, however, has been expanded, and he proposes a full-scale war. This amendment establishes a new objective for this broader war, to end the civil war in Syria that has already consumed almost 200,000 lives. Approving this amendment is the one vote that has been requested to enable this broader war. Without a declaration by the Congress to approve that war, and without knowing what commitment those in the region will really make in order to fight this war. I got a communication from a constituent of mine in San Antonio. Her name is Gloria Flores. And she tells me this. She poses some questions that are not being answered today in Washington. Quote, in my view, she says, ISIS is just one more extreme group, which if destroyed, will be replaced with another group. I don't say boots on the ground, because that phrase takes away from the terrible toll that will affect a family if its son or daughter is killed. My nephew was killed in Afghanistan, and we are still mourning his death. Any armed force should consist of almost entirely Middle Eastern soldiers. Why should American kids, she asked, carry the load for Saudis, Jordanians, etc.? Why indeed? But this purported coalition does not carry its own load. Others may appear in photos. They may cheer from the rear. But nearby countries are not risking their young people in ground combat. In one case, we even have a neighboring country that will not even permit us to launch an attack by air from its soil. With the number of our U.S. military on the ground already approaching 2,000 in Iraq, and with General Michael Hayden, the former NSA and CIA head, expecting 5,000 by the end of the year, the danger of escalation is very real. Now, I do find it difficult to understand with its hostility. May I have an additional minute?
I'll give the gentleman an additional 30 seconds.
With its hostility to Christians and brutal disdain for our American values, how Saudi Arabia can be a place for training anyone? Certainly no Syrian women learning to drive there. Ultimately, I believe that this resolution has to be evaluated on whether it secures our families in a stronger way. I think it entangles us in a conflict that we cannot get out of as quickly as those trained Iraqi soldiers drop their uniforms and their guns. Today is Constitution Day. Let us use our constitutional powers to consider a declaration of war before we enter this entanglement.
Republican Representative Tom McClintock from California said the administration was making a strategic error by siding against the Syrian government and would likely end up fighting the same people that the president was seeking to arm and train down the road.
Madam Speaker, all of us recognize the threat posed to our nation by the Islamic State. The question before us is whether to arm and train supposedly carefully vetted elements of the Free Syrian Army as a proxy ground force. I respect the intentions of the supporters, but this proposal runs a great risk of backfiring. The FSA is a marriage of convenience among many Islamist factions that have a long history of collaborating with the Islamic State. The singular purpose of the FSA is not to destroy the Islamic State. It exists to destroy the Syrian government that is now actively fighting against the Islamic State. The equipment we provide to the FSA could easily be turned against the Syrian government, which, despite all of its despotic tendencies, is at least at war with the IS right now, and we would weaken our overall strategic position. Or this equipment could be turned over to the Islamic State, as we watched carefully vetted Iraqi security forces recently do. In fact, that's the reason the Islamic State is armed to the teeth with American equipment. Neither we nor the world can afford more blunders or miscalculations in this region. We should have learned by now that alliances in the Islamic Middle East are in constant flux. An ally today is a sworn enemy tomorrow. In fact, often our allies are our enemies. You know, after I was elected, the first man killed from my district in Iraq, Army Specialist Jeremiah McCleary, died when carefully vetted Iraqi soldiers turned their American-provided weapons on him. The most recent fatality from my district, Marine Staff Sergeant Sky Moat, died when carefully vetted Afghan police turned their American-provided weapons on him. Madam Speaker, our consistent experience in this region should be screaming this warning at us. We're making a big mistake.
Democratic Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii said the president's strategy actually demonstrated a lack of commitment to fighting ISIL. She said the actual mission of the fighters the U.S. will train is not to suppress ISIL, but to overthrow the Syrian government, which she called an ineffective strategy, citing Iraq and Libya as immediate historical precedents.
Madam Speaker, I stand in opposition to this amendment because this proposed strategy actually reflects a lack of commitment to really destroy ISIL and the other Islamic extremist groups that we're at war with. Here are just a few reasons why I'll be voting no. First, it's unrealistic. It will take way too long, and the number of fighters trained too small to be truly effective in the fight against ISIL. Over that period of time, ISIL will continue to grow in strength. Number two, the mission is unclear. The American people want ISIL destroyed, but the primary objective of the fighters that we train will be to overthrow Assad. Number three, we don't really know who they are. Presently, they're fighting shoulder to shoulder with Al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremists, and therefore can't be trusted. The weapons and training that we give them may end up actually being used against us and our allies. Voting to support this proposal is actually a vote to overthrow Assad, because overthrowing Assad is the primary objective of the so-called Free Syrian Army. If we combine the missions of destroying ISIL and overthrowing Assad, this is not a smart or effective strategy for a number of reasons. We must focus on one mission, to destroy ISIL and other Islamic extremists who've declared war on us. Our mission should not be to topple the Assad regime, which would make the situation in the region even worse and more unstable than it is today. Madam Speaker, we've heard this story before. We know how it ends. Look at Iraq, look at Libya. Clearly, our leaders have not learned their lesson. We must focus on taking out our enemies and investing in our own country here at home.
The bill was set to come to the floor of the Senate for a vote Thursday, and we'll report on it tomorrow. More than 4 million registered voters were set to go to the polls in Scotland Thursday to decide whether their country would remain part of the United Kingdom or become an independent nation. RT's Polly Boyko was in Edinburgh at the opening of the polls early Thursday.
So that's it. The polls are now open, and after 2 years of talking about this referendum, it's finally time to put pen to paper for millions of Scots. Over 2,500 polling stations have opened up across the country in local schools, in community centres, churches, and Scots will be making their way there now to answer a simple yes or no question. Should Scotland be an independent country? Now, 97% of the population have registered to answer that question. That's over 4.2 million people. Now, it's thought that there are some 350,000 Scots still undecided today. That's perhaps 8% of the people that are registered. For the first time ever in the UK's history, 16 and 17-year-olds are going to be allowed to vote today. It's expected that over 100,000 under-18s are going to be casting their ballots. ballot. But it's expected to be the busiest day in Scotland's electoral history. And at 10 p.m., the polls will close, and we're going to have ferries, helicopters and planes helping to bring those ballot papers over to counting centres. Because remember, Scotland still has a lot of very remote, outlying regions and islands, and they're going to need all the help they can get to count the vote up as quickly as possible. Well, there's going to be an anxious wait for the whole country, and we're expecting the result at breakfast time on Friday morning.
We'll report on the results as soon as they become available. The truce in Ukraine is held for almost 2 weeks now, and although sporadic artillery fire can still be heard, the ceasefire has allowed many locals to emerge from bomb shelters and return to their homes. However, in many cases, there's not much left of those homes, as RT's Roman Kosarev found out.
Yulia is one of the few refugees who decided to come back here to Yasinovata. And just like many local residents who live here, they found their houses devastated. A shell fell right into this house, and the fragments of the ceiling have fallen on the floor. It's practically impossible to live here. And if you follow me into the children's bedroom, the fact that they were away during the shelling probably saved their lives.
I need to repair my house. I wish the shooting would stop. I have three young children, and I don't want to be doing this over and over again.
This is one of the more affected areas in the town of Yasinovata. We can still hear the sounds of shelling here and there. We can still hear fighting going on, and this is one of the more damaged buildings here. And residents seem to be returning here right now, and they find this place in complete devastation. And actually, I found one to speak with.
We were hiding in the basement for a week. Some of us just lost our nerve and we fled the city, driving through the artillery fire.
Those residents of Yasinovata who decided to stay here in the city during the most violent bombing are forced to live in bomb shelters like this one here. This is where they eat, this is where they sleep, this is where they go to the bathroom as well. And now there is no bombing outside at this moment, but they're still too scared to go outside because they know what it can turn into.
Yes, there were shootings today. We were very scared because innocent people are dying, including children. One rescuer died. He was from the emergency ministry and was trying to protect us and save our city. He went home to feed his dogs. He was here with us, then left, and in 2 hours he was dead. He was killed on the square outside a shop.
The humanitarian catastrophe is evident in everything that's in and around Yasinovata. Sporadic fighting can still be heard here, but fortunately, nothing's landed in the last 24 hours. Some see this as a good sign and hope permanent peace is just around the corner. Roman Kosarev, RT, Donetsk region, Ukraine.
As we reported earlier this month, children in Gaza returned to what was left of their schools, looking forward to, at best, an uncertain school year, immediately following the trauma of a war that killed parents, grandparents, and other children. But Gaza isn't the only place where children and their schools are victims of war. Children in Iraq face their own unique challenges in a country that has seen war up close for almost a quarter century. Press TV's Altaj Ahmad reports from Erbil, Iraq.
School desks turn into stores, classrooms into kitchens, and hallways into a sleeping space for 40 to 50 individuals at a time. Individuals who are complete strangers to one another. This description would match no less than 2,000 schools in Iraqi Kurdistan, occupied by Iraqi IDPs this summer. The official count of refugees in Iraqi Kurdistan has hit 1.4 million, many of whom are taking refuge in schools such as this one. With the start of the school year, students here worry they won't be able to continue their studies, as internally displaced people fear they could be forced to evacuate and end up on the streets any time now. The Ministry of Education and the KRG has recently demanded that all schools be evacuated before the start of the academic year.
We have 110 families here, around 550 persons. With the school year kicking off, it's only a matter of time before we will be asked to evacuate. We have no idea where to relocate the ITPs here too, and we're not sure if the displaced kids will be able to study this year.
This news has outraged many of the people here.
Our pockets are empty. We haven't been receiving any aid. ISIL has taken our homes. We have no place to go.
Our kids couldn't have out of school this year. We've been trying to enroll them in schools here, but they won't take them. We are scared for the future of our kids.
The kids also share their parents' concern.
We want to go back to our schools. We want to study and learn and play with our friends. They're telling us we could be transferred to tents, but winter is coming. We don't want to stay in tents. We want to go home.
ISIL's advance in Iraq's north has forced hundreds of thousands out of their homes. UNICEF estimates that some 200,000 displaced Iraqi children could miss out vital education this fall due to ISIL-led violence. Meanwhile, schools in Iraq are forced to cope with two or even three shifts per day. Altaf Ahmed, Press TV, Ain Kawa, Erbil.
And for children in Syria, another threat, bad medicine. According to media reports, medics carrying out a vaccination program in rebel-held northern Syria accidentally administered a muscle relaxant to up to 75 children, killing 15 of them. A preliminary investigation by the so-called Syrian National Coalition found atricurium was given to children instead of a solution used to mix measles vaccines. The packaging for the drug is said to be similar to that of the solution. All of the children who died Tuesday were between 6 and 18 months old. Their parents accused the opposition health authorities of not storing the vaccines properly or of using out-of-date medication. The U.S.-backed insurgents, however, blamed it on the Syrian government, claiming the mix-up was the result of a plot which included a, quote, security breach by vandals, close quote, linked to the government of President Bashar al-Assad. There may be some ammunition available for WIFCA, the private German fraud investigation firm with a client offering $30 million to anyone who can help identify those responsible for the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 in eastern Ukraine in July. A newly released English version of a report from the Russian Union of Engineers is making its way around and raising more than a few eyebrows en route. Entitled Analysis of the Causes of the Crash of Flight MH17, Malaysian Boeing 777, and citing both physical and forensic evidence made available thus far, the report concludes that the plane, quote, was destroyed as a result of air-to-air machine gun and rocket fire, closed quote, and not a surface-to-air missile, as the U.S. and its allies in Kiev have claimed. Coupled with forensic evidence and testimony of eyewitnesses who claimed they saw military planes in the area before the airliner crashed, the evidence strongly suggests that the Ukrainian military carried out the attack. Many eyewitnesses reported seeing military aircraft operating in the region where the Boeing crashed. According to the descriptions they offered, these aircraft most closely resemble the type of Russian-made fighter plane used by the Ukrainian military. The report said that the description by witnesses of aviation noise in the sky most closely related to MiG-29 or Su-29 fighter aircraft. According to the report, these planes carry armaments whose munitions would produce perforations matching those in the cockpit sections recovered from the scene, which appear to be shot through with small objects resembling machine gun fire. Another important piece of circumstantial evidence was a report from the Russian Defense Ministry that, on the 17th of July, Russian air traffic controllers tracked a plane of the Ukrainian Air Force, apparently a similar fighter jet, climbing towards the Malaysian airliner. The distance between the two aircraft did not exceed 3 to 4 kilometers, more than close enough for the fighter to shoot down the plane. 2 months have passed since the Malaysian airliner on its way from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was shot down in eastern Ukraine with 292 crew and passengers on board who all died. A preliminary report into the disaster carried out by Dutch investigators issued September 9th said that the crash was a result of structural damage caused by a large number of high-energy objects that struck the Boeing from the outside. Earlier this week, WIFCA said that the client, who preferred to stay anonymous, will pay $30 million to whomever provides evidence that identifies those behind the shootdown, adding that the money had already been deposited in Zurich. There were no reports as of press time as to whether or not the Russian engineers had yet submitted the report as a claim for the money. We will be following this as it develops. Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to India to deepen relations between the two Asian giants apparently is bearing fruit. President Xi met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi at Modi's hometown in the state of Gujarat Wednesday, kicking off a 3-day visit. Thus far, the two sides have already signed a series of agreements to step up cooperation. Sidhu Ram Sharma is the chair of the Maulana Abul Kalam Azad Institute of Asian Studies in Kolkata. He spoke with China's CCTV about the trip and relations between the two countries.
As you know, that both China and India rank among the front runners of global economy. There is a total economic convergence between two Asian economic giants. President Xi stresses on the fact that the economic development and prosperity provides a strong guarantee for security. It is therefore natural that the economic agenda is on the forefront of this important visit of the Chinese president. The visit, I'm sure, can write a new history in Sino-India relations. Of course, there are some concerns in India about the trade deficit, and India looks forward to China to further opening its market to the Indian goods and services. China is India's largest trading partner, but there are immense potential to increase the trade manifold. India is also looking forward to the investment by China in India in many important areas like infrastructure, railways, telecommunication, port, many areas. And I think in this connection, the recent announcement of China investing $100 billion in the next 5 years is a very significant and a major step towards the closer economic cooperation.
Well, Mr. Sharma, can you briefly share with us the features of Modi's policies towards China? What needs to be done to forge a closer partnership?
Under Prime Minister Narendra Modi, India sees China as a friendly neighbor. Modi is believed to be business friendly and is a person who looks for concrete results. I think that China's invitation to India to Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Beijing in November, then again China's desire India to play a bigger role in Shanghai Cooperation Organization and to join China in fashioning a new southern silk route of economic cooperation of which India is a part, are significant indicators to the increasing closer cooperation and better understanding between China and India in different areas of cooperation under Mr. Narendra Modi.
Mike check! Mike check!
Wednesday marked the third anniversary of the founding of what would come to be called the Occupy Movement.
We amplify each other's voices!
We amplify each other's voices!
No matter what's said.
No matter what's said.
No matter what's said.
So we can hear one another.
So we can hear one another.
Beginning with a protest of several hundred against Wall Street greed, it quickly mushroomed into a national and global outcry against social and economic inequality, political and economic corruption, and the influence of corporations on government, particularly from the financial services sector. The OWS slogan, "We are the 99%, addressed income and wealth inequality in the U.S. between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of the population. Decision-making was based on consensus arrived at in general assemblies, where participants emphasized direct action over elections and petitioning authorities for redress. Caleb Maupin is an activist with the International Action Center and a freelance journalist with Press TV. He was present at the beginning of the Occupy movement and participated in some of the early planning meetings. He spoke with us Thursday by telephone about his experiences with the Occupy movement, and we will bring you that interview tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.